English civil or private law. In the following sections, we shall examine extensively the basic concepts and terms as found in the area of English civil law, namely property law, contract law, and tort law. Law of property. The law of property regulates the various forms of ownership in real property, land, and in personal property, chattels. It's characterized by a great deal of historical continuity and technical terminology. In the language of the law, property embraces two concepts, ownership and possession. Ownership describes the exclusive right to use, possess, and dispose of property. Ownership is based on the rightful title of persons having a superior interest in the thing arising from law or agreement. In this sense, ownership describes the entirety of the powers of use and disposal allowed by law. Pollock, Possession in the Common Law, 1888. English law distinguishes between corporeal ownership, that is, a material thing which may be a movable, tangible items of property other than land and fixtures placed on land, or an immovable, tangible things that cannot be physically moved, particularly land and buildings, and incorporeal ownership, that is, something intangible, such as of a copyright or a patent. At common law, the general position is that the owner can alienate, transfer some of these rights, and retain others. For example, an owner of land may, by deed, expressly grant a right to cross or otherwise use his land for a specified purpose. This is known as right of way, or easement of way, to refer to a legal title. Or an owner of patent may grant a license to manufacture the patented goods. Possession describes the degree of actual or factual control of property, known as corpus possessionis, combined with the intention to use it, rightly or wrongly, as one's own. Intention to possess, known as animus possidendi. Only tangible things, such as a book or land, can be controlled in this way. In the case of land, however, a distinction must be made between actual possession, that is, the owner has entered onto the land, and possession in law, that is, the owner has the right to enter onto the land, despite he has not yet done so. Intangible things, copyright or patent, cannot be controlled, and thus cannot be possessed. The most common example of A, who lends a book to B, will lead B, the bailee, to be in temporary physical possession of the book. However, while the ownership of the book remains with A, the possession will remain with others who exercise temporary control. This process of separating ownership from possession is known as bailment, which is the temporary transfer of the possession of goods by the owner, the bailer, to another, the bailee. We understand, therefore, that property describes anything that can be owned, and licenses in law to say that A has the property in a house, or that A owns a house. At this point, it may be useful to know about the way of acquiring an interest in property, called transfer of ownership, which is usually by consensual transaction with the previous owner. This is referred to as possession acquired by consent, which may occur, for example, by will, gift, sale, or lease. A will or testament is a declaration made in the prescribed form of the intention of the testator, the person making the will, to dispose and devolve his property on or after his or her death. The declaration is said to be revocable, capable of being annulled, and ambulatory, literally able to walk, and in law capable of being revoked, since a person's will is ambulatory until his or her death. The term will, however, extends to a codicil, which is a supplement added into a will or testament after the finishing of it for the supply of something which the testator had forgotten or to help some defect in the will. Terms de la ley. A gift is a gratuitous transfer or grant of the ownership of property by the donor, which may be effected by deed or by donatio mortis causa, a gift on account of death. A lease is a contract whereby the owner of property such as land, the lessor or landlord, grants another person, the lessee or tenant, exclusive possession of the property for a fixed minimum period. The property held by the lessee is described as leasehold. Exclusive possession of the property leased, which is no more than the right to control the property and to exclude others from it, as we have seen, is usually granted in return for a rent or regular payment, and also implies an intention to create the relationship of landlord and tenant. As with a gift, a leasehold may be created by deed, which is itself referred to as a lease. At the end of the agreed period of the lease, the property must be returned to the freeholder, the legal owner. If possession is not exclusive, there is a license and not a lease. Where land is involved in the transfer or grant of freehold property by deed, the document which provides to do so is itself called a conveyance or transfer. Where the property is registered land, that is, the details are held in a central register. It is possible for property to pass from one person to another without the consent of the property owner. This is referred to as possession acquired without consent. This happens where a person goes bankrupt, has his property taken in execution of a court judgment, or dies intestate without having made a valid will, known as intestacy. Law of contract. A contract is a legally binding agreement between two parties, otherwise known as an agreement enforceable at law. It is the binding effect underlying contract which leads to the purpose of the law of contract, to provide remedy, compensation, redress or relief for breaches of enforceable agreements. As we shall see, an essential feature of a legally enforceable contract is a promise by A to B to do or forbear from doing certain acts in which the offer of a promise becomes a promise by acceptance. This type of agreement is usually spoken of as consensum ad idem, agreement as to the same thing, because it requires the common consent of the parties in order to have a binding effect. This, in turn, gives rise to rights and obligations between the parties. The requirements of an enforceable contract. For a contract to be valid and legally enforceable, that is, to come into existence, the following requirements must be met. Offer and acceptance. There must be a clear offer by one party, offerer, and a clear acceptance of it by the other, offeree. Intention to create legal relations. There must be an intention by both parties to enter into a legally binding contract. Legal capacity. The parties must have competence to enter into a contract. That is, they must understand what they are agreeing to. The main categories of persons lacking capacity to contract in full are children or minors, those who are mentally incapable or disordered, sometimes called patients, and those who are too intoxicated by drink or drugs to understand what they are doing. Consent. Consensus ad idem. Consent must be genuine, that is, it must be given freely, without duress or undue influence. Valuable consideration. This can consist of goods, services or money, or a promise to pay or provide them in the future. Legality of purpose. The purpose of a contract must not be one of which the law disapproves. For example, contracts to commit a crime, tort or fraud. Sufficient certainty of terms. No particular formality is required for the creation of a contract. For example, it may be simple or parole, that is, in writing or oral, partly oral and partly written, implied, based on the assumed intention of the parties, or even quasi-contract, based on the circumstances, irrespective of the party's wishes. Unless all the requirements are met, a legally enforceable contract will not be created, and the contract will be void, voidable, or unenforceable. Acceptance. The offeree must agree to all the terms of the offer. The principles regulating acceptance are that it may be inferred by conduct or words and not by silence. It must be unqualified, unconditional, although a request for information will not be considered as a counter-offer. It must be communicated except in unilateral contracts, when the offerer failed to communicate his acceptance, or when it is communicated by post. Hyde and Rensch, 1840, 3b 334, Carlyle and Carbolic Smokeball Company, 1893, 1qb 256, Bowerman and Abter, 1995, The Times, 25th of November. However, the offerer may stipulate a mode of acceptance. Consideration. As noted above, an agreement must be supported by consideration. Put simply, consideration describes what is actually given or accepted by the parties in return for a promise, the price for which the promise of the other is bought. As an element which transforms the agreement into a bargain, consideration may be, or include, the provision of goods, and or the provision of services, and or the payment of money. For example, A receives £20 for which he promises to clean windows to B. This price, £20, is the consideration for the promise to clean the windows. However, older cases treated as consideration any benefit that one party to the contract receives which is a detriment to the other party. For example, a promise not to take legal action even though there is a valid claim illustrates that the promisee, the person to whom the promise is made, receives the benefit of not being sued, while the other party, the promisor, suffers a detriment in not continuing with his valid claim. The words benefit and detriment occur in the celebrated case of Curry and Meeser, 1875. This approach to defining consideration has been seen to develop deficiencies where contracts are based purely on an exchange of promises. This, and other criticisms by academics, have meant that it is preferable to think of consideration in terms of a person buying the promise of another by performing some act in return for it. This price is what amounts to consideration as the bargain element of contract and as a criterion for the enforcement of promises. There are other main rules on consideration. Among these, a contract may be executed or executory. It is executed when the act constituting the consideration has been performed. One of the parties has done all that he's required to do under the contract, that is, he has executed his side of the bargain. Where the contract consists of an exchange of promises, that is, the consideration remains unperformed, the contract remains executory because it remains to be completed, performed, or executed, of promises at a future date. An example of an executory contract arises when A promises to purchase a van from B on credit, the delivery taking place the following week. Consideration must move from the promisee, but not necessarily to the promisor. For example, if A promises to give B £2,000, in return for B's promise to employ C in a car factory, A can enforce B's promise. Both parties must give consideration for a contract to be legally enforceable. If only one party agrees to do something, this is a bare promise, and no contract comes into existence. Thus, in the case of a promise by A to give B £50, there is a bare agreement to give, a nudum pactum, a naked agreement, based on the maxim ex nudo pacto non oritur actio. A right of action does not arise out of a naked agreement, and as such will be unenforceable as a simple contract, since there is clearly no reciprocity between the parties. If this gift is embodied in a deed being a document executed formally, then such an agreement will be enforceable as a specialty contract. Thus, no contract can be binding unless something is given or promised by each side, or unless it is given by deed, which is a more solemn form of promise. Whatever is given as consideration must be sufficient in law, though not necessarily adequate. Here, sufficient means that consideration, that is, act, forbearance, or promise, must have some economic value, however small or trivial, for which a valuable consideration is required. There is no requirement that it be of equal value to that which is given in return. The rule is that, in determining whether a contract exists, the law will only be concerned with the existence of a bargain, not its quality. Good consideration, for example, a moral duty, is not enough to make a promise enforceable. Vitiating factors. While the presence of the requirements outlined above give rise to a prima facie valid contract, there may be other factors which either make the contract void or voidable. First of all, a distinction between the two must be made. A void contract is one which has no legal effect from the moment of its making and is a complete nullity. Thus, it creates no legal obligation and does not bind the parties. The general rule here is that the parties must be returned to the positions they were in before entering the contract, pre-contractual position. This rule extends to restitution, restoration to the rightful owner, which means that if one party has unjustifiably received money or goods from the other, he is under an obligation to restore it to the rightful owner so that he will not be unjustly enriched. Unjust enrichment. This restitutionary obligation also exists when, for example, money or goods have been transferred under duress or under mistake by one of the parties, or even under a transaction that is illegal in its objective, illegal contracts. These factors will destroy the contract entirely, thus making it void ab initio. If the remedy of restitution is not possible, the court may order payment on a quantum meruit. A voidable contract is one which is valid when entered into, but where one party may have the option to subsequently set the contract aside. This constitutes the remedy of rescission, the setting aside of a voidable contract, the effect of which, again, being to return the parties to their pre-contractual position and to treat the contract as if it had never existed. The factors which render a contract voidable can be seen in the area of misrepresentation, duress, undue influence, and certain contracts with a minor. Thus, based on the distinction above, the main vitiating circumstances which make a contract void or voidable may be summarised as follows. Duress and undue influence. These two concepts assume considerable prominence in the context of unconscionability, where promises are extracted by physical force or other forms of pressure. If one party has been forced into entering a contract, that contract will be void or voidable. The law recognises two types of pressure. Duress. This is pressure, whether actual or threatened physical force, exercised on the injured party who has no practical alternative to agreeing to the contractual terms set out by the person making the pressure. Economic duress, as it is now known, renders a contract voidable. Duress is particularly relevant in the area of renegotiation of a contract, that is, performance of an existing duty to the promisor. Thus, the most common situation is where A threatens to break an existing agreement unless B agrees to renegotiate its terms. Undue influence. This is improper pressure or influence induced by a person on whom reliance was placed with respect to any transaction. This doctrine recognises the abuse of a privileged position of influence, that is, where the relationship between the parties is so close that it gives rise to the presumption that the stronger party exercised undue influence over the other. For example, undue influence arises where the parties were in a fiduciary relationship, for example, doctor and patient, or solicitor and client. Mistake. First, a word needs to be said about mistake at common law. Mistake is an erroneous belief about a question of fact, mistake of fact, or a question of law, mistake of law. While both types of mistake have no legal effect on the validity of a contract, mistake of fact by one or both parties may, under some circumstances, make the contract void or voidable. Three types of operative mistake, mistake that operates so as to avoid a contract, are recognised by law. Mistake as to the subject matter. This is a mistake that precludes the consensus ad idem of the parties. It arises when the parties are at cross purposes with one another, as, for example, when A is offering one thing, but B thinks he is accepting something else. One party believes the contract to be about one thing, and the other believes it to be about something different. This makes the contract void. Mistake as to the existence of the subject matter. This arises when, unknown to both the parties, the subject matter of the contract has ceased to exist before the contract was entered into. This is known as mutual mistake because the parties are under a mutual misunderstanding. This makes the contract void. Mistake as to identity of the person contracted with. This arises when one party believes he's dealing with one person, but is in fact dealing with a different person. For example, the party is mistaken by being given a false name, which is relevant for the decision to enter into a contract. This will make the contract void if the intention was to only deal with a specific person. Misrepresentation. This is a false statement of facts, not of law, opinion or intention, as they are at the time, a representation made by one party during contractual negotiations which induced the other party to enter into the contract. The person making the misrepresentation is called representor or misrepresentor, and the person to whom it is made is the representee or misrepresentee. Misrepresentation is only operative when it becomes an inducement to enter into the contract. This leads to the remedies which the misrepresentee may have against the misrepresentor, these remedies depending upon the nature of mispresentation, that is, the degree of culpability of the representor. The law recognises three types of misrepresentation, which make the contract voidable. with the equitable remedies also depending upon the type of misrepresentation. Innocent misrepresentation, the representor reasonably believes the statement to be true, that is, by mistake. The representee can rescind the contract, set it aside by rescission. Negligent misrepresentation. The representor unreasonably believes the statement to be true, that is, through lack of care. The representee can rescind contract and/or claim damages. Fraudulent misrepresentation. The representor makes the statement knowing it to be false or being reckless as to its truth. The representee can rescind contract and claim damages. Like the factors we have examined above, there are other effects which different circumstances can have on a contract. These circumstances will lead us to distinguish between termination and unenforceability of a contract. An unenforceable contract is one which is valid but will not be enforced by the courts. The classic example is that of a child who is bound by contracts made for necessary services and goods to pay a reasonable price for them. In this case, the contract is referred to as a valid contract, but cannot be sued upon in the courts. Therefore, it is unenforceable. However, there are contracts which can neither be enforced by the child nor be enforced against him, and include contracts for non-necessary goods and services, and contracts of loan. These are referred to as void contracts, as we have seen. Similarly, there are contracts which, although valid, cannot be enforced since they are not evidenced in writing, usually by lack of required formality. Termination or discharge of a contract is the ending of a contract so that nothing further is agreed under it. This may occur in four ways. By performance, both parties carry out the obligations under the contract. By agreement, both parties agree to vary it and a new contract is formed. Breach of contract, one party refuses to carry out his obligations under the contract. By frustration, the obligations under the contract become impossible to carry out through no fault of either party, that is, as a result of an event outside the party's control. Examples include where the party who is due to carry out a service under a contract is unavailable through illness or some other reason, in which case the contract is said to be frustrated, impossible to perform. Where a breach of contract arises, the following remedies are available. Damages. The aim of financial compensation to be paid in full for damages is to put the claimant in their anticipated post-contractual position, otherwise known as measure of damages in contract. Compensation in full means that there must be restitutio in integram. Where a party sustains a loss by reason of a breach of contract, he is, as far as money can do it, to be placed in the same situation with respect to damages as if the contract had been performed. Per Park B in Robinson and Harmon, 1848, 1 ext. 850. Thus, damages may be claimed in two forms. Liquidated damages, the parties have specified already in advance, in the contract itself, the amount of damages to be paid. Unliquidated damages, if there is no such agreement, the court will assess the loss and fix the amount of damages to be paid by the parties. While at common law, the only remedy for a breach of contract is that of damages, in exceptional cases, the following equitable remedies may also be awarded. Rescission, specific performance, rectification.